It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No Maria this morning?
No, she's sick. She's sick, I tell you.
She's out ill.
We do hope she feels better.
Yeah. She's trying to get over a fever. All right, let's. I got plenty to cover. So starting with local, and it looks like Ron Sims,
Mr. Smith goes to D.C.
Moving on to bigger and better things.
Yes, he was appointed. Actually, it had been rumored for a couple of weeks, but was confirmed early this week that he's going to D.C. to become the new deputy director of HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department, which means he will have direct responsibility for the day-to-day operations of the department, which is a pretty highfalutin position for Ron Sims. And it sets up a really interesting situation in terms of who will replace him. Now, he is not going to resign as county executive of King County until he is actually confirmed by Congress, but you know, absent any tax problems that we don't know about, he should have no problem with that, which raises the question of who will be the next county executive. And if you recall, we got Ron Sims because Gary Locke appointed him to fill out Locke's term when Locke became governor, and Sims stuck around for 3 more terms on his own. And so now we have the chair of the King County Council, Larry Phillips, angling basically for the same thing. He wants to be appointed to fill Ron Sims' vacancy, and then he probably, based on the rumors of Sims leaving for D.C., had actually announced his candidacy for this coming November's general election, in which that seat is up, actually a week before Sims left the door to D.C. So it was very much a don't let the barn door hit you on the way out kind of gesture by Phillips. And, you know, Larry Phillips is kind of a sterling example of the dangers of a one-party city. He is a Democrat in a city where Democrats are the only viable electoral party. And as such, he has basically had a lifetime sinecure on the county council where he has done little or nothing. But he seems to suck up or, I mean, make himself popular to all the right people in all the right places. So the fact that he has actually very little, legislatively speaking, to show for his tenure really doesn't seem to stop him from getting reelected because he never has any opposition. Now he wants to be King County executive, and I think we can remember what happened the last time we had a career legislative warm body on the county council take over an executive branch. We in Seattle have gotten a front row seat to that with Greg Nichols. And so there's some concerns. Phillips is trying very hard to line up 5 of the 5 necessary votes out of the 9-person county council in order for them to fill him to the nominate him to fill that vacancy, appoint him to fill that vacancy, which would give him a leg up as a standing incumbent for the November election. Sims, for his part, on the way out the door, said that he thought that whoever is appointed to the interim position should pledge not to run for the seat in November, that they should leave an open playing field for whoever wants to take that spot in November, which was clearly a shot at Phillips, number one, but also a tad hypocritical given how Sims himself got the seat. So it's going to be, from a spectator sport kind of viewpoint, an interesting process to watch that happen and see who gets appointed to fill that vacancy. But right now, the candidates are not very encouraging.
All right. Moving on, we just had an election this last week. How did that turn out?
Very well in terms of the outcome. Cheryl Huff ran and won the race to become elections director. She is already the elections director, but thanks to a Republican-sponsored initiative last November, the elections director, for some, I think, inexplicable reason, became an elected office, even though it's a technical office that requires specific knowledge of, you know, how to run elections. And we had two previously elected Republicans office holders running for the position that obviously had experience as elected officials and name recognition for that point, but didn't have any experience running elections departments. We had several minor candidates, three minor candidates also, who weren't particularly qualified, and Huff. And Huff won with 46% of the vote on a six-way race, which is really quite impressive, particularly considering that she was an unknown going into the race, and both David Irons and Pat Roach not only had name ID and not only had devoted partisan bases within the Republican Party, but had raised far more money than Huff. Irons, in particular, put over $100,000 of his own money into about $130,000 that he raised overall. Roach got a bunch of money from the Building Industry Association of Washington and also raised a bunch of money. And Huff was endorsed by a number of Democratic organizations, but really didn't raise all that much money. So she did quite well, and it really was a testimony, I think, to the fact that even though it was a very low turnout special election, that was the only thing on the ballot. It was just after the presidential election, so I think a lot of people were kind of exhausted by politics at this point. Not our dear listeners of this show, however. And we had also a special election where there was no precedent for having a special election for an office that most people didn't know existed. So, it was a very low turnout. It was the first time that King County went to an all male ballot system, so we actually still don't have the final results yet. But, it looked like Huff got about 46% of the vote, and, credit the intelligence of the King County voter.
All right. That moves us on to national news and the forthcoming stimulus bill.
Yeah. Now, I cannot possibly be the only person who thinks that this entire process, and granted, watching sausage being made is never pretty, and this is being made very publicly, but the whole process, if anybody's watched C-SPAN this week, of particularly the Republican posturing on various facets of this bill, has been really repugnant. We had an announcement on Friday that 698,000 jobs were lost in the month of January alone. This comes after rising unemployment for the last several months and to very worrisome levels. And then to put that in perspective, 700,000 jobs is basically, or rather 600,000 jobs, I'm sorry, 598,000. That's still about one in 350 working adults in the country lost their jobs last month alone. That is really a staggering number, and it really underscores that something desperately needs to be done to infuse capital, infuse money into the economy now. It underscores also that the TARP, the temporary program of $700 billion that was approved a couple months ago controversially, really hasn't done its job, because as Maria has been explaining week after week, the banks have been sitting on that money. They haven't put it into the credit markets. They've either used it to pay down their own debt, they've used it to build up their own reserves, or they've used it to acquire troubled properties on their own, but they haven't been lending it out to small businesses and to people who need credit in order to make major purchases. And so the economy is still stalled. There are a number of things that in an ideal world are kind of troubling about the stimulus bill. There's a tension in the bill between two different stated objectives by the Obama administration. One of them, of course, is to infuse money directly into the economy. And the Republicans have been arguing, as they always argue, that tax cuts are the magic elixir. The problem with that, of course, is that if you're one of those millions of people who doesn't have a job, then tax cuts aren't going to do you much good. Beyond that, the two conflicting sort of forks of the or goals of the stimulus package. One is to infuse money directly into the economy, and the other is to put a down payment on what the Obama administration calls, you know, transforming the American economy into a 21st century economy. That many of our economic policies and our investments by the federal government are predicated on an economy with a large manufacturing sector, and an economy that makes things. Most of those jobs, of course, have been exported under free trade to China and Mexico and Vietnam and various other low-wage countries. And we really aren't wired for the 21st century in terms of having an infrastructure in things like internet connectivity, you know, things like that. Seattle is actually an anomaly in how well wired it is, just to take one example. So there was a question about investing in order to make that transformation to the economy, making it more globally competitive, make it more green, investing in technologies, for example, that would fight climate change and lead to technology that would reduce and maybe at some point hopefully eliminate our greenhouse gas emissions, versus the imperative to put money into the economy immediately. And what we're seeing is that the Obama administration has largely opted for the latter, that it largely wants to put money directly into the economy now, and is foregoing a lot of the green investment and a lot of the economic transformation sort of rhetoric that it had put out before. Now, that's not to say that they might not pursue that later on in separate bills. And in fact, a lot of the language, a lot of the line items that are being stripped out of the Senate version and in the various debates this week are good ideas and ideas for investments in program that could probably pass Congress on their own with the Democratic majorities. But you're rarely going to see an opportunity to put so many eggs in one basket and get them all through at the same time as exists with this stimulus bill. You know, hopefully we'll see a bill this week, something that can be acted on relatively quickly. That's Obama's stated goal is, you know, by President's Day, which is a week from Monday, he wants to have it on his desk. So we'll see what happens with that. But the sausage making process has not been pretty.
I didn't see the details on it, but it looked like in the local papers this morning, just the headline suggested that there could be a vote on it this weekend. So that they've gotten that far.
Yeah, the Senate reached a tentative deal yesterday, or rather the Democrats did, with enough Republicans if they believe they have a majority to pass the legislation. But once the Senate passes it, it still has to go to conference committee where they hammer out the details between the Senate and House versions, and then it has to go back to both the House and the Senate in identical forms, state in identical forms, which means no amendments or coordinated amendments that are the same in both bodies, and then it has to be passed there. Then it goes to Obama for a signature. So there's still plenty of things to be done.
Gotcha.
Meanwhile, we had this particularly tone-deaf article today in the New York Times, in which the headline actually sort of says it all. You try living on $500,000 in this town. And it was making the case that those poor CEOs that Obama was urging to cap their salaries at $500,000 a year just couldn't squeak by on that little money in an expensive place to live like Manhattan. I think there's a certain amount of disconnect between certain East Coast elites and how the rest of the country is feeling right now. I know that I personally would be happy to take $500,000, put it in a safe investment, and live off the interest for the rest of my life. I think I can state with a fair amount of certainty that I could make do in $500,000 a year, and granted that Seattle is a less expensive place to live for Manhattan, so let's reduce that to $300,000 or $400,000. I could probably still get by. But it really does underscore how, I mean, this is the nation's largest newspaper, most widely read newspaper, and it's putting out tone-deaf propaganda like that. It really was pretty repugnant.
Must have been on the editorial pages.
No, actually, it was in the fashion section.
Okay, well, that explains it. All right, other economic-related news?
No, let's move on.
All right. Well, in the bad idea department, it appears that the Obama administration wants to move nukes and their responsibilities.
Yeah, the word came out that the Obama administration is considering moving the production and oversight of nuclear weapons from the Department of Energy, which admittedly... forgive me in advance for this horrible done. They have not done a bang-up job. But still, I would rather have the Department of Energy with all its faults, and at Hanford, for example, they have been legion. I would much rather have them handling it than the Obama administration's suggestion, which is to move it all to the Pentagon. This is problematic for a number of reasons. Number one, the Pentagon cannot manage its way out of a wet paper bag when it comes to fiscal responsibility. If you want to eliminate waste in government, that would be about the first five or six places to start. And really, there are very few programs that have more built-in waste than nuclear weapons production and maintenance, since there's no real use for the weapons. So that's one major problem. But there are a couple of others. Number one, the Pentagon's atrocious record on the environment. It exempts itself for national security reasons from almost all environmental laws, and many of the most polluted sites. Many of the biggest Superfund sites in the country are on military installations. That's one major problem. Another major problem is that, at least on paper, the United States has signed treaties saying that it's committed to the abolition of nuclear weapons, and we're seeing more momentum toward the abolition of nuclear weapons. You even have fairly conservative right-wing foreign policy hawks, people like Henry Kissinger, George Shultz from the Reagan administration, etc., who have come out in recent years saying, yes, these weapons are obsolete, and the only way that we're going to combat their proliferation in the rest of the country is that if we commit to and actually follow through on abolishing them ourselves and getting other nuclear powers to abolish them as well. They should be, we should put that genie back in the bottle the same way that we have with chemical and biological weapons, where yes, people can have the technology to produce them, but we recognize that it would be a crime against humanity to ever use them, and so why produce them? Why have that temptation in the first place for people like Dick Cheney to come along and want to use them? The problem with this, of course, is that the Pentagon is famously resistant to the idea of abolishing obsolete weapons. I mean, we still have hugely expensive weapon systems that are in production now in order to combat the Soviet menace. It really is, go back to one of my favorite buzzwords of yesteryear, mind-boggling how much waste is built into Pentagon weapon systems and how resistant Congress is to having any oversight or change in them, because they provide jobs in a number of congressional districts. The Pentagon has been very smart over the years in making sure there's a little bit of pork everywhere, so that almost every congressperson has a vested interest in making sure that the Pentagon budget stays bloated. That kind of environment is a politically extremely difficult environment to talk about real reductions in, let alone abolition of nuclear weapons arsenal. And so, for those reasons, it's a very troubling move on behalf of the Obama administration.
Yeah, those programs alone, the money that goes into those, if that was redirected towards other things, that I think that pretty much solve our economic woes right there.
Yeah, the money that's involved is mind-blowing. It's, billions and billions and billions of dollars that get wasted on these weapons and their oversight every year. And remember that there has been some accountability in the past. The Bush administration wanted to spend a whole bunch of money to begin the process of creating a new generation of nuclear weapons a couple of years ago. And one of the few victories for the peace movement recently, managed to get Congress to pull the funding for that. So that has not happened. And the Obama administration is not talking about that, at least not yet. But the stockpile that we do have is still, you know, several times larger than that of Russia, which is our nearest competitor in that particular realm, still enough to destroy all life on the planet many times over. And even though we seem committed to doing that in slow motion anyway, it would be really nice if we didn't do it all in one bang.
All right. Moving on, tell us, who is Leslie Hagen?
Leslie Hagen is an attorney who worked on Native American rights within the Justice Department until she was fired in 2005. Now, why would somebody in Monica Goodling's Justice Department be fired? Well, you could be fired for not being insufficiently Republican or insufficiently conservative or insufficiently Christian. Those were all firing offenses under Monica Goodling. But that's not why Leslie Hagen was fired. She was fired because a rumor reached Goodling. This was the ultra-conservative product of Pat Robertson's Regent University Law School, who has gotten herself in a number of legal difficulties working under Alberto Gonzalez in the Department of Justice, and she's still under investigation for a number of offenses, including hiring practices for civil service jobs based on political preference, which is a big no-no. But Monica Goodling fired this woman because of unsubstantiated rumors that she might be lesbian. This has several inherent problems with it, but the good news, and we here at Mind Over Matters are about nothing if not good news, is that the Obama administration has not only rehired her at her old job, but has also, it used to be on a year-to-year contract, and that position now is hers permanently for as long as she wants it. So I'm sure there will still be a civil suit in the works to try and reclaim back wages and whatnot from the Bush Justice Department, but for one, and for all the negative things we've said in recent weeks about Obama's start, that very definitely is change that I can get behind.
All right. Well, let's shift back to bad news now, to this week's police blotter.
Yeah, indeed. That didn't take long, Department. Michael Steele, who was just last week anointed primarily because he's African-American as the new head of the Republican National Committee, is now under investigation. He waged a losing campaign for a Senate seat in Maryland in 2006, and it turns out that, allegedly, and this is all about allegedly, he arranged for his 2006 Senate campaign to pay a defunct company run by his sister for services that were never performed. That's according to the finance chairman from the campaign and what that person has told federal and prosecutors. So Steele now in big trouble, and at a time when they just hired a reform candidate who promised to change the image of the Republican Party as one of corrupt cronyism. Well, it turns out he paid his sister a lot of money he shouldn't have. More things change, the more they stay the same.
All right. And news this week from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, a couple of different court items this week. First is that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Ginsburg has had surgery on Thursday for pancreatic cancer. She is reportedly doing fairly well and wants to actually be back on Supreme Court in time to hear arguments in a couple of weeks. But pancreatic cancer long-term is one of the more virulent forms of the disease. And the Supreme Court hasn't released any details, but chances are that her long-term prognosis is not very good. She's a survivor of previous forms of cancer. And this raises the question for the Obama administration, and it underscores one of the big, big differences in the 2008 presidential campaign between Obama and John McCain, is who Obama might put on the Supreme Court when vacancies come up, and they invariably will come up. It's not just Ginsburg. Justice John Paul Stevens is now 88 years old. David Souter is only 69, but he's indicated that he may wish to retire in coming years. And there are a couple of other possibilities among the aging justices on the Supreme Court. So that process and the possible politicization of that process, look for that to be a big story in 2009. And then on the state Supreme Court level, the California Supreme Court announced this week, and this, want to follow up wanted to follow up on this because there was a pretty large demonstration here in Seattle about this a couple of months ago that's going to be hearing arguments on Proposition 8, the anti-gay marriage amendment that was narrowly passed by California voters in November. That's being challenged in the courts, and the California Supreme Court is going to hear arguments on whether to overturn that election result on the grounds that the California state constitution prohibits essentially the denial of equal rights or prohibits voters deciding to deny equal rights to a subsection of the population. That can't be done under the state constitution is the argument. The state Supreme Court is going to hear arguments on that in about a month on March 5th, and then they should have a decision within 90 days after that. So we should know by the end of spring whether Prop 8 will be upheld or not.
All right. That takes us on then to international and Iraq.
Yeah, we had provincial elections in Iraq this week. We did not hear a whole lot about them as opposed to 4 years ago when it was such a big deal and a big hoopla with the purple thumbs and the exercise of the free right to vote in a democracy and yada, yada, yada. Well, you know, hundreds of thousands of dead people later, it doesn't quite seem like it's worth the price. But Iraq did, in fact, have provincial elections last week. Turnout was fairly high for it. There were literally hundreds of people on some of the different ballots around the country. And the preliminary, it'll take several weeks for all of the results to be counted, thanks to the very complicated coalition nature of Israeli elections and political parties. But the preliminary results are
Iraqi elections?
Iraqi, I'm sorry. so similar. But the preliminary results do show some interesting trends, particularly that the Sadrists, that is the followers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who has been a fierce critic of the occupation of the United States, and the ISCI, which is the dominant religious parties of the Shiites, are both down significantly in the polls. Now, the Iraqi government of Maliki was up a little bit from where it was 5 years ago, at least in a number of the cities that have reported preliminary results. That's not surprising since they've been in the news and established themselves, whereas they weren't established 4 years ago. But basically, this is more about a splintering of the different political parties, and there are now a number of different factions that are competing for influence and competing for control in various configurations of coalitions within the Iraqi parliament. So it's going to continue to be a mess for a while it shakes out.
All right. Well, that then takes us then to this week's events.
A couple of events today that I want to plug. This week is the 90th anniversary of the 1919 Seattle General Strike, a fine historical event that we would all do well to emulate someday. And there will be a celebration of that, and you can find out more about what happened actually in 1919, and that there's kind of a fascinating history behind it. That'll be happening much of this afternoon from 1 to 5 o'clock at the Labor Temple at Broad and First Street in Belltown. Also this evening, Code Pink is doing a special screening of a new documentary about, it's called Pray the Devil Back to Hell, and this will be showing at the Varsity all week. The particular screening tonight is at 7 o'clock, but it'll be there all week in the U District at the Varsity. This is a movie that I would really encourage people to go see if you really want to talk about what change looks like and what hope and mass movements can accomplish. It's the story of the Liberian women's peace movement and how they confronted Charles Taylor, who was really one of the more brutal perpetrators of crimes against humanity that we've seen on this planet in the last few decades. He was the dictator of Liberia. There was a long, long-running bloody civil war in that country, and in the early part of this decade, in the last part of last decade, the women's peace movement in Liberia said, enough, we're tired of seeing our men and our sons and daughters and ourselves suffer in this war. We're not going to take any more, and you are going to stop. And they stopped the civil war. It's a really pretty inspiring story, and you know, because it's sub-Saharan Africa, we don't know much about it. So I would encourage people to go see that. It's called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. It's at the Varsity Theater, and the Code Pink screening of that is tonight at 7 o'clock.
Very good. And then there's the continuing of the Seattle Human Rights Film Festival.
That goes through tomorrow.
Through tomorrow. So people can check that out. Their website, shrff.org.
That is correct.
Talking with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with the news and opinion and views of the world and our country and our local area. And we try to laugh at it whenever we can, too. It's all run by volunteers and kind of a labor of love. You find it wherever you find free newspapers at coffee shops and bookstores and the King County Library System and so on and so forth. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. We are always in need of volunteers. To the person who wrote in last week about the calendar editor opening, I haven't forgotten you. I'll try and get back to you today. But we also do have another opening for a volunteer, which is that we need help with the coordination of distribution. So if you're interested in that or would like to help out with any other aspect, we can always use distributors. And we always are looking for writers and new voices and new content as well. Drop us an email at editorial@eatthestate.org, or our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.